Hello and welcome back to the EV Cafe Takeaway. That podcast is focused on a zero emission future that we all hope for, and maybe you do too. And that's why you're here. And you're here this week to see and hear Chris Chandler, everybody, from Lex, Principal Consultant, I think is his official title. Chris, welcome.
Good morning, Paul. Good morning, JC. How are you guys?
I'm really looking forward to today because this has taken some time to put together. I think you may have been the most delayed podcast we've ever done because we've all had to rearrange it for various things, except you, the busiest man in the world.
I've been very patient, hasn't he?
Indeed, indeed. Almost lost it at one point, got to say. I think he almost threw his teddies out the pram, but he didn't.
Good I think man. It was more the tech that tried to this time. But no, really good to be here.
Great. Well, Chris, listen, for those people that have been under a rock for a little while, perhaps you would be kind enough just to let them know, who are you and where are you from?
Yep, certainly. So, I'm Chris Chandler. I've actually got a couple of roles, but I'll start with the easy one. I'm Principal Consultant at Lex Auto Lease. Been there 19 years now. And effectively, Lex Auto Lease is the business-to-business leasing arm of Lloyds Transport. So I'll go in and I'll talk to large fleet operators about anything to do with fleet, and we advise them on cost savings, we advise them on sustainability, we advise them right vehicles, right application, health and safety, anything really to do with fleet. And we've got a team of consultants, we've got experts in tax and finance, and although we can all do the majority of the elements of fleet, we do have specialists for specialist areas. And my specialism is sustainability and alternative fuels, which in more recent years has taken a much stronger focus on pure electrification. And that's where my second hat comes in, because Lloyds Transport is actually three business units. So you've got Lex Auto Lease, which, as I said, is our B2B. Then we've got Tusker, which is our salary sacrifice business, which has grown massively. So Lloyds Transport acquired Tusker just over 3 years ago. And in that time, they've gone from 22,000 vehicles to, we hit this week, 100,000 salary sacrifice vehicles with Tusker. So incredible growth. And the last part of the business is the largest, which is Black Horse, and that's our retail finance. So across those three brands, I'm also the SME for electrification. So a lot going on.
And it's not only a lot going on in that you cover three bases, you cover the most important bases for electrification. We covered on the news just recently that leasing and SalSac account for something in a region of 50% of all EVs on the road. I mean, what you're doing is actually driving the whole industry forward. Does the responsibility of us weigh heavy on you, Chris, that you're doing this and it really matters?
I think that's a really good question, because I think it's easier now, because I think that the direction is clear, the technologies are clear. I leased the first Nissan Leaf in the UK to one of our customers. I leased the first hydrogen fuel cell vehicle to one of our customers. And before that, I was involved in, biofuels, etc. And if I go back to the late 90s, early noughties, it was a lot more sticking your head above the parapet and sort of say, look, this is where the futurescape might go. People will care about the environment. People will be sensitive about what they drive, etc. And there were more options on the table. I think now, electrification for me is the clear way as the major fuel source, if you like. The technology is going in leaps and bounds. It's a lot easier now to go into a fleet and talk about electrification with vehicles that typically the average range now for a new vehicle is over 300 miles. They can charge, a lot of them can charge over 150, 250 kilowatt. Some can do faster now. It's different challenges. Back in, you know, 2011, where we had the first EVs, you're talking sort of 70, 80 mile range. And if it charged at 50 kilowatt, wow. and so, yeah, I think earlier it felt risky. I think now the issue is not the risk of the technology and the direction. It's the risk of how quickly we get there and how many barriers are put in the way.
Yeah.
Which is quite a different dynamic.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting journey. And just for those of you in the wider world, of course, Chris is solely talking about cars at the moment because we haven't got vans that do technology like that yet. But we're getting there, aren't we, Chris? But thinking about that journey, you know, from the late 90s through to the noughties. I mean, I drove my first electric van in 2004. We launched the Mercedes eVito 2008. But what has surprised you most, and what have you been excited by over that journey? What are the sort of key milestones that you've seen? And perhaps talk to us about where you think it might be going as well. Just, you know, where's the next steps?
I mean, you're absolutely right, because when John was talking about the you know, colossal uptake in numbers from leasing perspective, yeah, you know, cars have moved really quickly. And to my mind, it's very simple. If the incentives are there, then people move at pace. And you provide benefit in kind incentives where people can actually turn around and say, look, okay, it's a new technology. It's something different. In my head, I'm taking a risk, but there's a financial benefit to offset that risk. Then I'll move quickly. And that's why, you know, within our car fleet and you know, Tusker, which is salary sacrifice, which is obviously based on affordability and low BIK and tax breaks, the market runs fast. And I think if I look at company cars, the key things that have caused the acceleration has been the right tax environment. And you know, we can think back, you know, not too many years ago when the tax was suddenly hiked on electric vehicles and the tap just turned off. And then it was brought back down to zero and the tap was switched on again. So, you know, the cars have moved at pace. And I think the right financial incentives have done that acceleration, but also there's been technical accelerations. And, you know, I know people's views of a certain brand can be polarizing, but to me, you know, Tesla was one of those seminal moments where you go, right, here's an electric car. It's quick. It looks nice. It's a technological powerhouse. They put a charging infrastructure in place that actually charges quickly and simply. That was another accelerator to growth. And I think where commercial vehicles have been on a different trajectory is because, although there have been the plug-in van grants, there hasn't been the focus on commercial vehicles that there have been with cars. So if there's not that financial incentive that's big enough for the operators to save money, then that market's going to be a slower market. And cars are more price elastic than commercial vehicles. You get a commercial vehicle to do a job. You need to get people, kit places, deliver things, and it's much more transactional. It's a financial requirement. So I think, firstly, you got that cost dynamic without the incentives that we've had in the car market. And secondly, it has taken longer for the technology to move into the van space and those disruptors. And I think a lot of the vans we've had previously have been conversions of petrol and diesel vehicles, and it's only now where we're getting the bespoke electric vehicles, and that's what you need for a successful electric vehicle, in my view. We went through that learning process with cars, and we're going through it with commercial vehicles. And I think that the Kias, Horizons and brands like that, that are doing clean sheet of paper, getting higher ranges, making them more affordable, is where you'll start seeing the vans take off as well.
If you operate a fleet of cars or vans, you'll know electric is the future. Transitioning to EVs can appear daunting, but with Europcar, it's effortless. Our long-term EV rentals eliminate the upfront costs, contract commitments, and uncertainty. Instead, you'll get total flexibility, a wide choice of cars and vans, and Europcar's expert support. So, make the switch without the stress and experience Europcar. Search Europcar Business.
I think that's a really interesting point that you raised there, that sort of seminal moment for the car world really kind of was Tesla. And we all dismissed it, didn't we? We sort of looked at it and went, oh no, you know, no dealers, no, you know, a complete change. But what they did was everything, or a lot of things, well. We've also seen the Chinese learn from what Tesla did in terms of, I don't know what their dealership model looks like in China, but certainly that ecosystem model of vehicle plus software, tech plus charging infrastructure. BYD are particularly well known for this in China, with lots and lots of depots, sort of charging hubs, I should say, across the country, and obviously now doing that in the UK as well. I'm sort of keen, like you, to see the additional ground-up electric vehicles, such as like the Kia has hit the market with some, you know, really generated some interest. The VW ID. Buzz was a similar sort of scenario. Of course, Horizon now coming with electric-only offers, you know, with their SV and their V7e. We've got vehicles that are coming into the market. I do think the naming culture could do better. We've got PV5, ID Buzz, which is probably the best of the three, and the SV or the V7e. I mean, okay, guys, let's put a little bit more thought into the name, you know, but apart from that, we're getting there, aren't we? Is that where you see it all going now, these, you know, and car or van? What's the next step?
Yeah, it's to me, it's a lot more about thinking about the vehicles and the charging. And let's face it, from fleet and from a manufacturer perspective, all we've ever done historically is look at the vehicles. So as a leasing company, yes, we help with the management, but we just provide a vehicle. And manufacturers have done that. And I think we've seen good examples and bad examples of legacy manufacturers and new manufacturers getting it right and getting it wrong, because to a great degree, the car going electric opens up other avenues. It opens up charging infrastructure. It opens up home charging. It opens up home energy systems. So within our business, our core business, which is obviously Lloyds Banking Group, we do mortgages. We do all sorts of lending. And, we're now going through processes and taking the view that if somebody wants a vehicle from us, we've always done the charger, but what about further back end stuff? What about, do you have solar? Do you have a home battery? Do you have, and the one I'm excited about is V2G, because all this technology should be working together and shouldn't be looked at in isolation. And some of the manufacturers, and I'll go to Tesla again, have had this pretty good right from the start. One of the big things that I desperately want is plug and play charging. Apps, tap cards, all these sorts of things. It's great when you're starting off and you're trying to learn how the industry should work. But there's actually a solution that's been created previously, and that's what we should be following. You should be able to just plug your car in and it charges. And so for me, looking to the future, it's the simplification of having an electric vehicle, and it's how that then integrates and helps with other elements that will help reduce your costs and increase the sustainability and, in fact, the resilience of our country, because you can move away from this central energy system that's moved around the country down wires, and you can start saying, do you know how many megawatts of storage capacity we've got in people's houses, where you only need to take a percentage of that. I talked to people about VTG, and you go, well, what if I wake up in the morning and my battery's flat? You're not going to give that much electricity off of your individual battery unless you want to, when you want to be really clever and sweat your assets. But there's so much more there. So Futurescape, I think we need to simplify, but we also need to maximize the benefits of the battery systems, the charging systems. There's a lot to go at now, and it's not just the vehicles, in my view.
You strike me as somewhat of a visionary in the, you know, you've been doing this for nearly two decades. Sorry to, you know, give it to you in a big lump there, but almost 20 years. And when you started your journey of trying to decarbonize transport, it was pretty well unheard of. People didn't have that conversation. And you've kept knocking at different doors saying, well, perhaps it's hydrogen, perhaps it's CNG, perhaps it's this, perhaps it's that. Let's look at this. And you work for a traditional finance house, a bank ultimately, who are not noted for their vision or embracing change. And I wonder, being a visionary, does that mean that you've had to be very patient or very, what's the word, cunning in how you affect change?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to make an admission now, which is even worse. I've been doing this for longer than 20 years. I know, I don't look it. I started in the industry in 96 as an independent consultant with a small company in Petersfield. And I started with a passion of vehicles. I'm a quantity surveyor by training and by qualification. No Monty Python quips, thanks. I was made redundant in 91, did a lot of various jobs from driving armoured cash-in-transit trucks to anything I could make a few pound out of, started my own company. And then I came across this advert for a fleet management consultant. I thought, no idea what that is, but let's research it. I got a job there in 96. I just started looking at sustainability, tailpipe emissions, when it really wasn't trendy or really thought about, and got involved with an organisation, the Greener Transport Forum, which was government-backed, and met some fab people like Robert Evans, who's obviously now Senex. And we were tasked to look at a number of things. And it was through that work and through the company I worked for that I ended up in 99 doing the feasibility and design for CO2-based company car tax, which was a first to have a similar. Now, some people don't like me for it. Some people are okay. But the actual scheme to me, and I looked at a lot of things, NOx, SOx, size of a vehicle, its footprint, weight. It's about 18 different ways of taxing vehicles. And CO2 was the one that gave you that linear or near linear, if people want to get really technical, near linear connection between how much fuel you burn and your emissions. So you use CO2. And the nice thing about it was polluter pays, not with banning the dirty vehicles. And, you know, it did move markets. The idea was to affect manufacturer product, what people actually chose to buy, then what manufacturers actually make. And I worked with a lot of manufacturers over the time, you know, of doing that. And it was just based on this simplicity of, we keep burning this stuff. It is a limited resource. It isn't really that great. There's got to be a better solution. And that's where I just personally got involved in all sorts of weird projects where you're looking at, things like biodiesel. So he looked at running biodiesel vehicles. I did some work with Southwark Council, and they were running their waste vans, refuse vans on biodiesel. But the problem was, you know, as Paul will know, if you're using a bio-based diesel, it will wax at a higher low temperature. And, you know, you get all sorts of bacterial growth and all this sort of stuff. So it's proven really hard. So, you know, I work with a number of people in the industry to look at, well, what do you do? So instead of having a number of vehicles running on 67% biodiesel, that then you have to ramp down during winter because you can only go to 40%, just put 5% mix into all the fuel and it won't affect any of the vehicles. None of them will need modifying and it will work at lower temperatures. So you get
RTFO, is that right? The road transport fuel obligations?
That's right, yeah. So at the end of the day, what you're getting is the same CO2 reduction, the same volume out there, but you're not actually affecting individual vehicles and having to do, you know, massive amounts of work on those vehicles. And it's things like that that then start shaping. You think, right, well, what you've got to look at this from a technical, technology-based grounding to work out what you think might be best. And for me, quite clearly, early on, electrification was something where, you know, I went from, when I left Quantity Surveying, I did a bit of civil engineering for a little while and I had a mobile phone and it was a briefcase, literally, with the handle was a pigtail headset and the battery lasted for 15 minutes. And it was brilliant because I left it off all the time so nobody could phone me. If I needed to contact somebody, I could. And it was actually better than modern phones because it was a one way system. But, you know, and then only a handful of years later, you've got a mobile phone you can hold in your hand. So you start looking at technologies and the what ifs and where could it go. And that was the interesting thing for me. And electric, to me, just seemed the right one. And, you know, looked at a lot of different technologies since then. And I suppose one of my frustrations is when you get these people going, oh, look at this mine that's been excavated for cobalt. No, batteries aren't clean. And you think, yes, but once that cobalt's been through the system once, it can be reclaimed and used again, time and time again. Oil, once it's burned, is burned. And, you know, oil refining is not a zero energy activity.
No, absolutely.
And there's a lot of transport, you know, involved. And, you know, I don't know what it is now, but when I looked at it in detail a good few years ago, you know, a third of all marine cargo was oil-based.
Mm. So well, we're seeing that now, aren't we? Straits of Hormuz, you know, the world has ground to a halt almost.
So why not generate it at home from some solar panels that will last for 20, 25 years and have this more sustainable ecosystem? That's really where it came from. But it's always been, I've had two passions which slightly conflict, and one is cars and the other one is sustainability. So it's just bringing the two together. But those early years are harder because you know, when you're in the pub and you're talking about it, you are the nutter. You know, you are the milkshake man.
So within the banking world, and you know, as I said, your business is very much financially focused. How easy has it been to get them to understand the potential of the things that you see very clearly? Because I suspect that in the early days, they were sitting there going, oh, hold on a minute, there's risk attached to this. And then there's a whole load of compliance issues. And oh my goodness, there's 101 reasons why not to do something. But Chris Chandler was the guy who said, well, hang on a minute, here's all the reasons why you should do something.
Yeah, and you know, I've been there 19 years, so it's obviously not been bad. I think the interesting thing was I was in a small company looking out at corporates. And after 11 odd years of doing that, I thought, if I'm really going to advise corporates properly, I need to understand the beast. Because most of the companies I was dealing with were large. So I was actually headhunted for Lex, and I thought at the time they had a team called Lex Momentum, who was sort of really known in the industry. It was one of the first lease cos to have, I think it was the first, to have a dedicated consultancy team. So for me, when I was approached, it was a no-brainer. And interestingly, the scale gives you two things. Firstly, it gives you a loud voice and impact. So I could go to people, you know, with the Lex brand and talk to them and get through doors. But then, yes, it gives you those restrictions of all the corporate risk and everything behind that. So, I mean, Lex are very forward thinking. Thankfully, you know, Lloyd's, because it wasn't Lloyd's when I joined. You know, Lloyd's have some objectives, you know, helping Britain prosper. And in our electrification, it's leave no person behind. So we're trying to do the affordability. And yeah, it really cares about that. And so what I found, yes, it is challenging. And sometimes I've had to pull my hair out because people don't share the vision, et cetera, et cetera.
Evidently.
Gone.
yeah. We've all been there.
we've all worked hard, haven't we? We've all worked hard.
Indeed. Seemingly.
But you know, you have that. You have that backing, which really helps. But you do have tighter governance and risk control that you need to have to manage. And quite rightly, you have to manage it because, you know, you've got big brands that can't be seen to be doing anything controversial or negative or cause harm to people. So it was very much, and everybody involved in the EVs and the transformation will know this, it was very much finding the right people in the organisation to trust you and back you. And it was finding the customers who wanted to lead and wanted to lead the transition. So, you know, the first Nissan Leafs that I put out, I got the first two and they were the first two because I actually secured them off of Nissan themselves, went to Coca-Cola Enterprises. Now, one was a pool vehicle and one was a vehicle at their head office and one was a vehicle at one of their factories to do a lot of the sort of gophering. Now, Coca-Cola said they wanted to do something and these new electric vehicles were coming. So I asked if we could do a proof of concept and do a low risk introduction of these vehicles with that customer and do promotion off the back of that to show that electric vehicles can work for a big corporate, etc. So in a way, it's harder because you do have to really hunt out where you can do it, make it work to prove it works so that then you can then continue that path. But in another way, you know, you have got the backing of you know, Lex behind you to do these things. But yeah, it's sometimes very frustrating. But then when you watch what can happen when things go wrong, you do need those guardrails in truth. And what I try and do, what consultancy tries to do on the whole, is find customers who want to move and then we'll do a proof of concept or a trial. And that'll be quite extensive so that we can identify known risks, unknown risks. And then we can do a process to ensure that, right, what's worked, what hasn't worked, and how do we make this customer ready? Because what we can't do is give customers products that are going to fail. And that bit of governance is probably the hardest bit and the most frustrating because it takes a while, but it's the right thing to do.
Quite right, yeah.
And all of this, Chris, as we're chatting away, I see a very rounded, very knowledgeable, very committed, very dedicated, very effective individual. And I can't help sort of thinking back to when you had hair. And
wow.
Sorry, but what I'm thinking is, like, it sounds like you trained as a quantities fair. I don't know if that means you went to university or that sort of thing. But what was that part of your life? I want to understand the foundation of this very rounded, very solid, very apparently quite academic, quite knowledgeable, studious, but yet still able to...
Who knew? There's a brain in there somewhere.
That I've always known, I guess. I
crawler.
I have.
Well, not sure I have.
Yeah, but you don't do... Because I've worked in a big leasing company as well and with the consultancy team, and they're always the bright ones. They're always the ones that, you know, the clever ones that sort out problems and sort of stuff. And you bring them in. You still have to tell them about commercial vehicles from time to time. But, you know, apart from that, you can kind of trust them. But what was that early journey like? You know, what were you like at school? Were you like me, sat at the back of the class, glue sniffing, or were you nearer the front doing all the proper stuff?
Yeah, difficult one. I think I was always, I've got a bit of a low boredom threshold, and I'm very tough on myself. So I always challenge myself, and often unfairly, and sometimes I have to sit back and think, you know, at the end of the day, come on, you know. But I just always, my parents instilled the work ethic in me, you know, work hard, achieve things, don't waste time. I went to a comprehensive and local county primary school. My next door neighbor was a building surveyor and had his own business and drove an Audi coupe. So I thought, hey, money, that looks like a good career. And quite interested, well, very interested in being out and about and doing things, not just sat behind a desk, ironically. So that put me into surveying. So when I went to do my A levels in the summer holidays, I worked in the surveyor's department to learn about surveying. Then I decided to do a degree in quantity surveying at Portsmouth. And in the holidays, I was working at
I'm from Southampton.
Well, I've lived in both, so there you go.
And you know the truth. Southampton, number one. Portsmouth, somewhere else.
Can possibly comment.
Diplomatic too.
So I did a degree in quantity surveying, which is RICS exempting sort of thing. So I then went straight into practice. And, you know, so a lot of work, really wanted to do that. And in 91, there was the recession. And I went from 8 job offers and going straight into a top job to being made redundant and spending the next couple of years writing letters to every surveyor in the south of Britain. And they're all laying people off or not taking any on. So there's then my brother worked as assistant manager at Security Express, which is a cash in transit operation. One of their guys was shot and sadly died in hospital of complications. So they didn't have many people queuing up to do that job. So I took it.
So, quite literally dead man's shoes.
Dead man's shoes, yeah.
So wow. I took the job, expecting to be there 5 to 6 months, ended up there nearly 2 years, learnt a lot about fleet. You know, the fact that if you put, in those days, you put a bolt, you weld a bolt under the accelerator to stop them speeding, and then a guy comes in with a monkey wrench and bends all the accelerator arms up to get max power still. So I found out the what man can make, man can break mantra in the commercial vehicle world. And I think that taught me, I then went through a number of jobs until I found fleet. And that just taught me that, you know, you like to quote Aerosmith, your life's a journey, not a destination. You can have all these wonderful plans, but at the end of the day, you've got to make the most of where you are and what you're doing and look for open doors. And that's really the kind of, you know, way I kind of live, and I try and teach my daughters to just look for opportunities, look for stuff that's interesting. And I genuinely believe the only way you can be truly good at something is if you're passionate about it. And, you know, I love vehicles. I like trying to make a difference. I'm not somebody who, you know, is going to get political or have a go at somebody for having a vehicle that runs on petrol. I ride a motorbike that's petrol. But the point is, we need to decarbonize transport. So the vehicle that I use for work and I use to go to shops, et cetera, is electric. My wife's vehicle is electric. Yes, I do have a petrol motorbike. You know, when we got rid of horses because our inner cities were turning into open sewers because of all the excrement from the horses, we didn't get rid of every single horse. We just got rid of the problem, which was horses in city centres. And my view is classic cars, motorbikes, if there are certain niches where we still have petrol, we still have petrol. But what we've got to stop is all these vans, trucks, cars that drive up and down the motorways doing billions of miles a year, get them into the, you know, the cleanest, most sustainable solution. And of course, the other thing is, you know, the cleanest miles, the one not driven. We could have all gone to a studio for this. We could have traveled hundreds of miles, but instead we're doing it through the internet. So, it's just thinking differently and working differently. And if everybody does a bit, then the collective, you know, impact is way more than one or two people saying, right, I'm going to stop doing everything I love and I'm just going to sit here doing nothing because of the impact on the environment. You know, let's keep it real and let's just all make a difference together. And that's the, you know, that's the way I see it personally, just a personal view.
Chris, what's clear is that we started in school and how you came through that, but we've naturally kind of ended up back firmly at the heart of sustainability and, you know, that the advocacy that you bring so naturally into every conversation. Where does that come from? What was the trigger point that said zero emission is the way to go? There is the what are the reasons that you care about sustainability and making this difference that you're talking about?
If you talk to my daughters, and I don't use labels, I'm old school, but they say I've got OCD. But I get really wound up at waste and I like efficiency. And there's just something, you know, waste for me, I just think, why? When you think of the journey of getting the food on the plate, et cetera, et cetera. I was in Japan recently, and the incredible thing there is the restaurants close when they run out of food. And you book the night before so that rather than having all this food waste, they just turn around and say, no, we've done all the covers we need to. We've got the business that we need. We've used all our food. So that's it. And you just think, you know, is it really that bad to turn around and say, oh, sorry, we've run out of that, but we've got this and that, rather than having fridges full of stuff you throw away. So even when I go on holiday, I get silly about stuff like this. But it is just waste. And you just think, you know, we've grown into a very wasteful society. And again, when I go back to the, you know, I was looking at how we get about and why we get about, et cetera, you just think, well, there's cleaner, more efficient ways of doing it. So why wouldn't you? And it's, yeah, it's my daughters will probably say it's annoying, but it's just something that I've always thought about efficiency and what have you. And so, yeah, I'm quite passionate about it. And I think the important thing that I have to do in my job is I am passionate about it and I don't mind showing that passion, but you have to stop short of being evangelical and telling everybody they have to do the same thing. You've got to show people, in my view, you've got to show people there are better ways of doing it and try and help them along that path. You know, I don't like saying we all have to do this now and if you don't, then you're this or that. And I think that's one of the sad things about our EV journey at the moment. It's getting political, which I don't think it ever should be.
Let's pick that up, Chris, because one of my fondest memories of you is seeing you on the Green Fleet EV rally in a 7-year-old Tesla Model S with the legend that was Quentin Wilson. Talk to me about the time that you spent with Quentin on the rally, because that was where you were an advocate probably more than ever. You're always at the forefront of telling the story, showing it can be done. And Quentin was much the same. Must have been a very special time.
Yeah, and you know, I'd known Quentin for a good few years, and it was really, you know, terrible that he should be taken so soon. But fabulous memories. He came on the rally with me twice, but you know, he was always difficult to tie down because he was always really busy, but he always had time for people. And that was something I always found amazing. You know, the guy was so busy, but he'd always find time for you. And he did a day with me on the rally previous, and then had to shoot off because his phone went mad. I forget what it was, but something had been announced government-wise and his phone just exploded. And I said, look, you need to go and deal with this. So I dropped him at a train station and he went home halfway through the day. And then when I turned around and said, look, Quentin, I've got something I think you'll really like. I've got an eight-year-old Tesla with 250,000 miles on the clock. You know, it'd just be brilliant if you could. So he said, I'll be there for 2 days. So he came for 2 days on that. And, you know, wherever you stop, somebody goes, oh, Quentin comes over. And, you know, at one point we're in a real rush, but he always stopped and said hello to people. But for me, in that Tesla, you know, we had 2 days chatting, and the thing that always amazes me with Quentin is just his encyclopedic knowledge of vehicles. And it is encyclopedic, you know, I don't say that lightly. You could talk about any vehicle, the most obscure thing you could possibly think of, and he'd driven it, he'd seen it, he knew the guy who designed it, et cetera, you know, absolutely encyclopedic.
Was there a nugget? Was there something that Quentin passed to you, some information, some knowledge that you clung on to and thought, I'll never forget that?
Oh, that's a difficult one
the opportunity to be with a genuine knowledge base is so rare. And I guess you were bombarded by lots and lots of information. But I just wondered if there was a little nugget that he passed you that was just genius.
Yeah, I don't know that I can actually put my finger on one because we talked about so many things. I think the thing that impressed me the most was the way that he could come under fire, especially doing interviews on TV against politicians or whatever. I think the way he always held himself, regardless of what was thrown at him, and he always came back with a measured, calm response and always ended up with a high ground. And I think, you know, that there are a number of interviews he was in that we chatted about, and I just thought I'd have probably got a bit annoyed by that stage or said something. But, you know, he was always, you know, always a gentleman. And, you know, I don't want to start repeating some of the sort of political discussions, but I think it was the way he always commanded the technical and the moral ground rather than, fighting back with the fire that was sometimes thrown at him. But yeah, a genuinely lovely guy.
I think I had the pleasure of doing some filming with him for a day. We booked him for a client of mine, and we had a day in the what's the museum? The British Motor Museum in Gaydon. And so, of course, he'd driven most of the cars that were in there, and we were sort of walking around. And every now and again, we'd get stopped because he would take time to chat with somebody. And I think that, to your point, Chris, it's that example that he left of consistency, solidity. He was very firm. His foundations were strong. He was pretty immovable. He was always calm. Wasn't always not grumpy, because occasionally he could be. But that said, to everybody that was looking in, he was the personification of the calm, knowledgeable, measured individual with a ton of knowledge, and it was great.
I'm after something, Chris. You have an encyclopedic knowledge of the vehicles that are in the marketplace now. And I just wonder, an electric vehicle that's a sleeper, that's one that gets overlooked, that is underestimated, that people really should give a go to, what would you recommend?
It's a sleeper? Oh, no, you really put me on the spot, aren't you? Now, if you'd asked me 12 months ago, I'd have told you JQ.
There's cheating.
But, you know, you'll see all the new stuff that's coming in as well. So, you know, there's a lot from China. I know you had the BYD seal on the rally, which was hilarious to watch. there must be something that you've seen and think, God, I wish people knew how good this was.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much coming in, and that's the honest truth. If we go back 10 years, I'd driven every electric vehicle available. Now I'm not even sure what's coming in the next 12 months, because I think they've said there's another 150 models hitting the marketplace in the next 12 months. So, you know, it's really hard to keep up. And I think the interesting thing's going to be is how Joe Public respond. So if you look at the Jaku, let's be honest, it looks like a Range Rover Sport. And it looks nice. It's got tech. It's correctly priced. You know, it's a good value proposition. And so, you know, March, it was the UK's highest selling vehicle, full stop, and people hadn't heard of it 12 months ago. And it's hitting these sweet spots. You can even look at iconic vehicles, if you like. So, only Ford brought out the Capri. I would argue, not a Capri. And I've had Capris, and I've got
Fact,
a Capri.
Not a Capri. I mean, it's just...
But then you look at Renault, who brought out the Renault 5. Now, I remember the Renault 5. My first ever company car was a Renault 5 GT Turbo. They had it off me pretty quickly when they realised I was only 21. But anyway, I had it for a couple of weeks. And you look at the new Renault 5, and you think, wow. And you've got all those little bits that hark back, the stitch line dashboard, all these sorts of things. But somebody like my daughters who are in their mid-20s, they look at it and just go, wow, what a good looking bit of kit. And you've married both. You've married the heritage with modernity. And I think design and the emotional connection that people have with vehicles is soon going to be a lot more important than the spec and the badge, because
it's a bit like us, mate, isn't it? In that, you know, we've got the heritage, but damn, we're still cool.
I like to think so.
I suspect our various offspring may disagree.
What do they know? They're young.
Yeah, kids. What do they know? I mean, but Chris, I think you once again nailed it. I think there's so much tech coming in from brands that we've never heard of, and Jaku coming from Chery. These are giants of manufacturing in other countries. I think the thing for me in vans is just Korean tech. I think, you know, Hyundai, Kia in particular, obviously with the van side, but both their vehicles are ones that I think have historically been sleepers, but I think, you know, I think quietly everybody is aware that they're waking up. But really cool.
And I think the interesting thing is, if you go back a number of years when electric cars were in growth phase, you kind of had, if you like, the Tesla and the Polestars that were seen as, you know, leading. And then you had some legacy manufacturers who were further down the charts and were still learning. And you had Hyundai and Kia that were probably nearer the Tesla Polestar than the pack. So, you know, they did lead. And, you know, I actually worked quite closely with Hyundai with their first offering, getting them into fleet. Because they were well-engineered vehicles with good range, good charging capabilities. And to be honest, I'm pleased they're in the light commercial vehicle space. And I think they will be one of the brands who will grow big time in the commercial vehicles in the same way they managed to leverage it in cars. Because again, Hyundai weren't on company car lists until... you know, that they had their, the e-Niro and Kona for the Kia Hyundai brands. That's what got them onto company car lists. And I think you're right. I think those Korean brands and some of the Chinese brands are going to come in strong. And, I just hope that the likes of Volkswagen, Ford, etc., Vauxhall, you know, really take the effort to bring competitive products to market. And as I said earlier, it is the ground up vehicles that I think you need. You know, we've learned from cars, if you try and make a platform all different drivetrains, you end up compromising on all of them. If you build it electric from the ground up, there's so much you can do to increase the efficiency, because that's what you're designing into the vehicle. And this is where it leads on to, you know, like I said, my passion about the techie bits of it. And it's why, you know, I did a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle. There were very strong reasons for doing it. It was for a University of Birmingham who study hydrogen. So they wanted it as a test mule as well as one of their facilities vehicles. But we went in eyes wide open. I got it to a point where financially it worked for them. And I told them all the issues that they would have, and they accepted all the issues that they had. Some of them they had, some of them they didn't, and some were worse. But it was that learning experience. They wanted to learn. We were willing to lease it to them so that we could learn. And you start realizing just how complex that technology is. And, you know, who knew if you park up hydrogen fuel cell for a good few months, that the membranes in the cell start to die off, which is what we had with it when the local refueling station shut down for a prolonged period. So, you know, it's all learning and it's all understanding. And from my perspective, if I'm advising our customers, I don't want to go off something that I've read secondhand or something that I don't have a decent knowledge of, because we want to make sure we're giving the right advice. And that advice has to come from either your knowledge or somebody that you know, where you can share, you know, that knowledge so our customers are, you know, informed.
Indeed. What a wonderful conversation. And sadly, we're running out of time. So it comes to that point where we get to do our closing tradition. Because, of course, any podcast needs a closing tradition. And Chris, today, you get to be handed the EV Cafe magic wand. Yes, indeed. Look, lightning bolt, Harry Potter. You have got the wand coming to you across the airwaves. There it goes. Over to you now. And he's got it. Look at that.
Unbelievable.
It'll do.
See?
It'll
Portsmouth. Do. It had to come out. Portsmouth. Believe anything.
Cheapen it.
Somewhere in the bottom of my wardrobe, I have that Harry Potter one, but we won't go there.
Oh, yes. But anyway, Chris, you are now empowered. You are empowered to make a wish. And you can use this wish any way you choose. So over to you. What would you wish for?
Remove all misinformation and mistruths from social media.
Right. There we go.
And that's not just in the EV space.
Just
that's
all of it.
Because there's so much rubbish out there. So it's now, I think, adversely affecting people. It's adversely affecting their decision making. And I think social media can be used positively, but unfortunately it's being used more and more in the negative. And, you know, I mean that from personal perspective. I mean that from children and youth, but also to bring it back to this, you guys know how much rubbish that we get about EV batteries last 3 years, then you need to replace them. They're catching fire left, right, and center. You know, here's a photo of an EV on fire, and you're thinking that is very obviously not an electric vehicle because it's got a 12 plate on it. And, you know, all these sorts of things. And I just think I'm one of these people who like knowledge, and every day's a learning experience. And there's so much that you can find through learning. And I think all this rubbish that's out there is just not healthy. And so if I had magic wand, it'd be clean up social media.
Clean up social media and delete all misinformation. Absolutely. Control-Alt-Delete all everything. Yeah. John, this has been a great conversation, hasn't it? So much insight over such a long period of time.
Do you know, what's really fascinating for me is the first time I spent any time with Chris was between about midnight and 2 o'clock in the morning, waiting for a taxi to go home from an award ceremony. And it was like going to university because Chris talks and Chris knows. And I spent 2 hours learning so much stuff. And I'm not just buttering you up. And 6 years later, here you are, still astounding me with the depth of your knowledge on our industry. You are quite remarkable. You are calm, collected, driven to do stuff quietly, but you just get it done. And anybody who listens to this will think, that guy's a huge resource for any organization, for us as individuals. You're just fabulous. And I can't thank you enough, because over the years, you are a friendly face. Whenever I rock up at a charge point on the rally and you're there, you always have a hello, you always have a smile, and you always have a hug. Love you, man.
Very kind of you to say. I do remember that time. And just to put a perspective on it, it was Gaydon. There were no taxis about. We were stuck there for 2 hours, and I've never seen somebody phone a taxi so much.
It's true. No. Anyway.
You're not known for your late nights, are you, John? Let's be honest.
No, mate.
Chris, I mean, this, you know, John has taken all the superlatives away, but it's a fabulous conversation, and just the depth of knowledge over that long period of time just pours through. And Alexa, very lucky to have you. The industry is very lucky to have you, and you know, supporting the companies as they make the transition, it makes such a heck of a difference to have this sort of level of knowledge and experience over a real long period of time. You know, to bring to bear in every conversation. So we really appreciate you. Thank you so much for spending the last hour with us. So we're very grateful. Thank you, Chris.
Absolute pleasure. And, you know, always lovely to see you guys, and love the stuff that the EV Cafe crew do as well. You know, it's all about getting the right messaging out there and letting people know what's possible rather than what the, you know, what the naysayers will say can't happen. So that's been a pleasure.
That is all of our pleasure. But so everybody, listen, if you've enjoyed this chat with Chris, then please do share it with others. Connect with Chris, of course, on LinkedIn. That would be fabulous. And follow all of the antics of the Greenfleet Rally, which Chris and Lex are the principal sponsors of. But you can also check out all of the other podcasts on evcafe.org/podcasts or Apple or Spotify or all of those other places. Follow us on YouTube. Connect with us on LinkedIn. Do all of that amazing stuff. But until next time, have a lovely day.